And welcome back to the Critmedic Podcast, where we bring together the worlds of critical care and pre-hospital care. I'm your host, Dominic Wallenzak. So, I had an entirely different topic written up for this week's podcast. But then something so big and significant came along that I had to shelve that podcast and tackle this head on. I journeyed into this topic and climbed through a mountain of material. It was like climbing the Alps. In fact, it was the Alps. The lame pun that I'm trying to talk about here is the recently released amiodarone, lidocaine, or placebo study, or ALPS for short. And as its name implies, ALPS compares amiodarone, lidocaine, or placebo in the context of a non-traumatic, out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. It was released on April 4th and has immediately caused confusion and misunderstanding, even among physicians. The confusion is understandable, given the context. The study, funded by the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, says, quote, "Neither amiodarone nor lidocaine resulted in a significantly higher rate of survival or favorable neurologic outcome than the rate with placebo among patients with out-of-hospital cardiac arrest." However, the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, which funded ALPS, released a press statement saying, quote, "Antiarrhythmic drugs found beneficial when used by EMS treating cardiac arrest." Those mean, literally, the exact opposite things. I'm calling out the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute on their press release. Their headline and press release is unethically misleading. Anyways, get your climbing hats on, Critmedic listeners, because we're about to tackle the Alps. Okay, I think that pun is used up now. Every year, about 300,000 people die from out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. I would actually postulate that 100% of people who died did so from cardiac arrest. Just give that a moment to sink in. The problem with our current understanding and management of cardiac arrest is that we're treating them all like a cardiac rhythm problem rather than, in many cases, the terminal end of a complicated disease process. People who died from acute asthma attacks didn't die because they didn't have enough amiodarone or lidocaine in their system. Similarly, people who've died an unknown time prior to medical contact often get the same care as someone who codes just as EMS arrives on scene. Yet guidelines and studies often paint all cardiac arrests with the same broad brush without really addressing the fundamental differences between each type of cardiac arrest. ALPS somewhat addressed these variables, but you really have to dig deeper than the abstract. So ALPS was carried out at 55 EMS agencies across North America, and what they did was apply ambulances at those services with a study kit containing pre-filled syringes of either 150 milligrams of amiodarone, 60 milligrams of lidocaine, or saline. The syringes were identical, aside from tracking numbers, so EMS providers had no idea what they were giving. Neither did the hospitals know what the EMS providers gave, unless they called the study and requested emergency unblinding, which only happened 24 times in the study, which is less than 1%. Patients got two syringes, if they're over 100 pounds, for the first dose, and one syringe 5 minutes later. Now, if you think about it, I instantly see a problem with the dosing. This is the dosing scheme that is ideal for amiodarone. 300 milligrams repeat with 150 after 5 minutes. But lidocaine is meant to be a repetitive bolus. It seems that the setup of this study, particularly with the dosing intervals, favors amiodarone. The population that was included in the study was anyone who was in non-traumatic, out-of-hospital cardiac arrest and had recurrent or refractory shockable rhythm after one or more shocks, including those by AEDs. Patients were excluded if they were allergic to one of the study drugs, or if vascular access, whether IV or IO, wasn't established. Because it's kind of hard to study the effects of IV medications when you can't establish a route to give it. So, what were the primary results? Of nearly 300,000 non-traumatic out-of-hospital cardiac arrests, only 7,000 had shock refractory to VF or VT at some point during their care. Around 4,600 fall into the intention-to-treat category with open trial drug kits. this number gets whittled down to just over 3,000 based on study protocol criteria. So they have about 1,000 in each group. When they crunched the numbers, they found that the amiodarone group had survival to discharge of 24.4%. Lidocaine was next best with 23.7%. And saline had a survival of 21%. On the surface, this would seem to support amiodarone. But hold on, we're not quite done yet. There's something called the confidence interval. It's actually a rather involved statistical analysis and, frankly, far too boring for me or anyone else to really want to talk about it at any sort of length. It does not deal with the study value being between that range. The data is black or white. Either it is that statistic or it isn't. In that study, amiodarone did, in fact, perform numerically better than placebo. The numbers are there. But we cannot take the outcome of a study as a predictor of future outcomes without considering a certain degree of uncertainty. Polling, population, especially margin of error, they all play a role in the development of a statistical confidence interval, which tells us how well they expected to perform with a 95% confidence. So, how well is amiodarone expected to perform in the confidence interval? It falls between negative 0.4% to 7%. This means that they're saying, we are confident that amiodarone will either be slightly worse than placebo or maybe a bit better. That's one hell of a marketing point right there. Amiodarone, not proven to be statistically worse than placebo. The authors of this study realized what this was telling them. In fact, their very statement in the study was, quote, in this randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled, pre-hospital trial, we found that treatment with amiodarone or lidocaine did not result in a significantly higher rate of survival to hospital discharge or favorable neurologic outcomes at discharge than the rate with placebo after out-of-hospital cardiac arrest caused by shock refractory initial ventricular fibrillation or pulseless ventricular tachycardia. There were also no significant differences in these outcomes between amiodarone and lidocaine. Now, that's a statement on the whole sum of the results. And in general, I agree with their conclusion based on the evidence. But, as usual, the devil is in the details. We need to go deeper. Off to the supplementary appendix. Now, this sounds like an extremely boring compendium of useless study-related minutiae, but it is actually super interesting in this case because it gives us a detailed breakdown of the figures. Let's look at the data for the location of rest. About 30% of the patients in the study coded in a public location, and the data shows that, across all medications, their survival rate is 50% higher, relatively speaking, for those who coded in a public location than in a private one. That makes sense, and it confirms what other studies have already told us. If you code in a public place, you are more likely to survive. About 30% of the public place arrests survived to discharge versus 20% for the private ones. Probably because if you code in public, someone is more likely to see you, call 911 early, and provide bystander CPR. You may even receive shocks from a public access defibrillator. Because how many people have a defibrillator in their house? Well, actually, I do, but that's another story. When you look at that data, you also notice that amiodarone and lidocaine performed about dead even in the private locations, both about 3.5% over placebo. But once again, the lower confidence bound is negative 0.7%, meaning you can't really say that it helps at all. Now let's take a look at how it was given. About 20% of the study medications were given IO instead of IV. This is where the data starts to get interesting. In the IO population, amiodarone has a negative 3.1% survival rate compared to placebo, with a confidence interval of negative 10.7 to 4.5%. Lidocaine fared a little bit better, but still worse than placebo. So, we can probably say if you're going IO and thinking about amiodarone, why bother? Now, the interesting factor is what happens when you look at the IV population. The amiodarone group had a 5.2% increased survival over placebo, and the confidence intervals are positive. 1.1% to 9.4% with a p-value of 0.01. So when we exclude the underperforming IO administration, amiodarone seems to be helpful, but only just a little. Moving on to bystander CPR, would it surprise anyone if I told them that the group that received bystander CPR had a 10 to 25% higher survival rate than those who did not? At this point, I should hope not. The one thing that the study highlights is that bystander CPR is far more important than whether we give amiodarone or lidocaine, and it seems that a push towards community CPR education should be a major focus. Anyways, the split between CPR and no CPR was about 60-40, respectively, with more people receiving CPR than not, which is very encouraging. But when you look at the no bystander CPR branch, amiodarone had a negative survival rate compared to placebo at negative 0.3%, with a confidence interval of negative 5.5 to 4.9%. It did worse than lidocaine, which showed a 4.5% increase over placebo in this subgroup, but lidocaine's confidence interval was negative 0.9% to 9.9%, which still includes zero, meaning it's not even necessarily predicted to work better than placebo at all. Lastly, let's talk about witnessed arrest. The study breaks it down into EMS witnessed, bystander witnessed, and unwitnessed arrest. And it comes as no surprise that the best survival percentage comes from the population that coded in front of EMS. Well, excluding probably the percentage that coded due to paramedic assistance, of course. EMS is armed with, in theory, thorough training of CPR and armed with a defibrillator, whether manual or automatic. The public is usually not, and unless you're wearing a Zoll life vest, you're not getting defibrillated early in an unwitnessed arrest. So EMS witnessed arrests account for about 150 patients total, with about 50 in each trial group. The amiodarone group was about 22% better than placebo, with positive confidence intervals and a low p-value. This would suggest that when given an EMS witnessed arrest, amiodarone is helpful. But you have to take that with a degree of caution. When we're comparing amiodarone versus placebo, we're comparing just over 100 patients. That's tiny. That's barely enough to tell us anything. It's underpowered to draw any significant conclusions. On the other hand, there are over 600 patients in each group of the bystander witnessed arrest. When we look at the survival rates versus placebo of amiodarone and lidocaine, we see that they improved survival by 5% and 5.2% respectively, with a positive, albeit small, lower confidence bound. So in witnessed arrest, amiodarone and lidocaine are neck and neck, whereas if you look at unwitnessed arrest, the impact of amiodarone and lidocaine versus placebo was negative 1.7% and negative 0.8% respectively. Meaning in an unwitnessed arrest, we cannot say that those drugs do anything at all. So let's pull it all together. What does this mean for us? When dealing with your fresh kills, so to speak, bystander or EMS witnessed cardiac arrest, bystander CPR having been performed, giving amiodarone to the patient IV may be of some small benefit. Outside of that narrow group, the evidence does not, to any degree of statistical certainty, say that amiodarone nor lidocaine are any better than placebo. Does that kill amiodarone for us? Well, not necessarily. The American Heart Association guidelines have even acknowledged that neither amiodarone nor lidocaine, while improving ROSC, have ever increased survival to hospital discharge. The evidence against epi is even higher powered when you look at survival and neurologic outcomes. Yet ILCOR and the AHA are so fixated on the surrogate endpoint of ROSC that they don't really seem to care about the real goal, neurologically intact survival to discharge. So until there's a fundamental shift in ILCOR, I wouldn't expect to see any significant changes. Plus, this study overall wasn't a very high-powered study to begin with. It does suggest that we should look at witnessed arrests differently from unwitnessed arrests in terms of treatment methodology. And no, the frequent nursing facility quote-unquote, witnessed arrest of, well, we just saw Mr. Johnson 5 minutes ago, Yeah, well, when you saw him 5 minutes ago, did you fail to notice the mottled skin and dependent lividity? Yeah, that doesn't count as witness. So you may have caught me slamming epinephrine just a moment ago. Since we're talking about coded drugs, why not talk about that one as well? Epinephrine has long been a staple of ACLS. We never really looked at the long-term survival or neurologic outcomes. We had epidoses in the past that were as high as 10 milligrams, or we would jam a needle directly into their hearts. We found that those methods were hurting our patients, so we stopped and changed what we were doing. And a Japanese study suggests that we do just that. I won't bother you with the technical details of that study, but let's just say it included 3,000 patients with epinephrine and 400,000 without epinephrine. So they had a large number of participants in the study. However, it wasn't a blinded study, it was just retrospective. But what the Japanese study concluded was, quote, among patients with out-of-hospital cardiac arrest in Japan, use of pre-hospital of epinephrine was significantly associated with increased chance of return of spontaneous circulation before hospital arrival, but decreased chance of survival and good functional outcomes 1 month after the event. We may be bringing more patients back, but we're bringing them back as vegetables. But speaking of blinded studies on epinephrine, I'm not sure how many of you are aware, but there is a study taking place in the UK right now that promises to possibly be the final nail in the coffin for epinephrine. The Paramedic 2 study is the world's largest placebo-controlled blinded study on the efficacy of epinephrine. The study goals are not only rate of ROSC, but also to monitor survival to discharge and neurologic outcomes. It will settle the question one way or another. And the results are due out in 2018, just in time for the 2020 ACLS guidelines. We may see ACLS, as far as cardiac arrest care, be nothing more than a footnote at the end of a BLS-CPR course. Not that I think epi doesn't have the potential for benefit, just not the way that we're doing it. How much are your epinephrine drips? 2 to 20 mics per minute? Maybe even as high as 30 mics per minute? We've always harped on, be careful with epinephrine for cardiac patients, though that risk we find is somewhat overblown. Yet how much epi are we giving to the sickest cardiac patients of all, cardiac arrest? 1 milligram every 3 to 5 minutes. That equates to a rate of 200 to 333 mics per minute, an order of magnitude more than we'd ever use otherwise. And we're not giving it at that steady rate. We're slamming it in 1 milligram boluses. When you look at it in that context, I don't think our epinephrine scheme is logical. So what do I think should happen? Well, to speculate, mind you, this is pure speculation with little scientific evidence, I think you'll see us maybe hang a liter bag of epi 1 to 100,000 and run it in over the course of a cardiac arrest. Lower and smoother dosing, less spikes. I think that such a reduced administration scheme will result in improved outcomes. In 20 years, we'll look back today and say, wow, we really thought that slamming high doses of epinephrine was a good idea? We were silly then. Of course, Paramedic 2 could always validate the use of epinephrine, and I'd have to eat my words. If I'm still around, you're still around, and the show is still around in 2018, I'd be happy to break down Paramedic 2 for you when it comes out. Mark your calendars for 2018. Listen, I hope you all have found this breakdown of ALPS informative. I know going over study material like this can be a little bit dry, but it does have the potential to impact far more patients than my original topic this week, which was on emergent cricothyrotomy. But no worries, that's just been shoved and pushed back 2 weeks. Because next week, on April 17th, we're releasing a podcast on something that will spell out the future of EMS, something as game-changing as getting 12 EDKGs on the ambulance, if not more so. I'm talking, of course, about EMS point-of-care ultrasound. Except even better than me talking about ultrasound, we'll have Peter Bonadonna, Director of Paramedic Education at Monroe Community College, one of the biggest ultrasound proponents on the East Coast, who will give a whole presentation on the topic, including a video. Whereas I was not able to sway the opinions of many of my peers, he has changed minds and perspectives. He's one of the best people to present on this topic, so mark your calendars for Sunday, April 17th, because that day, we grab our ultrasounds and take the EMS social media world by storm. Until then, Crit Medic listeners, keep your ultrasound jelly warm and keep thinking differently.